I like to listen to NPR radio at various times of the day, and they have been running for the past month or so, it seems, a kind of an announcement. I think there must be a seminar coming or something. I don't remember all the details of it, but the thing that catches my attention in it every time is they say 1 in 5 women report being sexually assaulted while in college. 1 out of 5 on college campuses, 1 out of 5. When they surveyed people, and I did some Googling, and there's several studies that report the same numbers. And it varies from place to place and campus to campus and that kind of thing. You know, they kind of go up and down, some worse, some better. But overall, the people they check with, 1 out of 5. Now, sexual assault, I'm not going to go into very detailed descriptions of that, but it would cover everything from unwanted contact of a sexual nature all the way up to what we would think of as rape. And all that lumped together, 1 out of 5 during their time in college, which is a very alarming statistic. In fact, the numbers are so prevalent, I hope this is not the case, but just with the sheer number of people we have present here of all ages, chances are somebody here has been a victim of a sexual assault. I hope that's not true, of course. But it's the kind of thing that people often don't talk about for obvious reasons, and you wouldn't necessarily know if one of our sisters or brothers who's here, because it actually affects men as well, just to a lower degree, has perhaps been subjected to unwanted contact by somebody. Some people almost doubt that it could possibly be that bad. In fact, when I shared this information on a Facebook post from this study, after I heard the radio thing several times, I Googled it, and I found, I don't know if it's the very study they were talking about, but the numbers were the same kind of percentages, and it might be the study that the radio announcement was based on. So I shared that on my Facebook. If you'd like to read more details about it, you can certainly go look at that and see kind of what they're reporting. But what the first comment on my post was by this brother, and he says, statistics of this sort, a similar 1 in 4 claim about sexual assault in college has been floating around for years, generally seem outlandish to me. Mainly because if people genuinely believe this, I cannot comprehend, they would send their daughters to college. Paying tens of thousands of dollars for a 20% chance of being raped is not a deal any vaguely sane person would make. Well, does he have a point? We have several young ladies in our number here who will be most likely going off to school in the next year or two. And so it's something that certainly catches my eye, and I bet it does some of you as well. And so it's something to think about. And given that this seems to be a fact that has been reported over and over, not just some kind of shocking headline that's been blown out of proportion, but it does seem to be based on very real statistics and very real data, what it brings to my mind is, and Sabrina and I've already had this conversation, and we'll probably have more of them, but like, what can we do as parents? What can you do as a young lady? What can people do in general to be protecting themselves against this kind of thing? I mean, it's apparently just part of the sinful world that we live in, that this kind of thing happens. And, you know, what can someone do to be on their guard against it? Well, as you read more into the details of the story, and even during this little radio thing that only lasts for, I mean, probably 20 seconds at the most, but they say, the next thing they say is, on the NPR thing, of these accounts, over half report that alcohol was involved, either on the part of the perpetrator or on the part of the victim. And in the study that I read, you keep reading down in the details of it, and they say, among those assaulted, percentage who had been drinking alcohol just prior to the incident is 62%. In fact, this trend fits a larger trend that the National Institutes of Health .gov, so these are not like religious sites, these are just people who are trying to study these things and understand what's going on, report that of violent crimes in the country, over at least one half of all violent crimes involve alcohol consumption by the perpetrator, the victim, or both. So even if you enlarge that beyond just sexual assault on campus to violent crimes in America, at least half of all violent crimes involve alcohol consumption by one or both parties, either the perpetrator or the victim. That's an amazing statistic that links together the effect of alcohol and these kind of assaults. And so that's really what I want to explore. Interestingly, there's quite a few scriptural examples of this very thing that relate to the kind of trend that we're talking in, the connection between being drunk and being assaulted, or being drunk and assaulting someone. And so that's what I want to bring to our mind this morning, and then we'll make some applications. Of course, this will be broader than just young ladies heading off to college. It really is something that I think we can all learn from, but with a special emphasis with that on mind, just because of the particular report that was in the news. As we go back to the beginning, I'll have most of these passages on the screen, but I will ask you to turn to one or two as we go. But the very first appearance of wine in the Bible is when Noah got off the ark. And it says in Genesis 9 is when the ark had landed after the flood and Noah got off. And it says he began to be a man of the soil. He planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the brother of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on their shoulders and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward. They did not see their father's nakedness. The thing that's significant about this is that it really goes to the whole point of one of the things that the articles that I was reading talked about. And that is, as they would survey people about their experiences, one of the terms they used very often was incapacitated. Assaults that happened while someone was incapacitated. And what they mean by that was they were unable to give consent. So when someone is intoxicated, they can become intoxicated enough to where they don't have the mental capacity to say yes or no. And in that state, they're very vulnerable to someone having their way with them, because the person is not able to resist, because they don't even really know what's happening. And it's fascinating to me that in the very first mention of the word wine in the Bible, this is a similar picture is painted of someone who was probably what we would describe passed out. Noah has become drunk and he's asleep and he's uncovered. And it seems that this was an unusual thing. This doesn't seem to be the way he normally took his nap. Because the brothers go in and notice it, and Ham comes out and he tells his brothers, and they go in backwards trying to cover their dad up, which gives you the impression that this wasn't just a normal everyday thing. This was like unusual. Why is he laying there naked and uncovered and exposed? So we need to protect him, because why? He's not capable of protecting his own dignity. He's not mentally in a state of keeping himself, keeping his privacy. He's exposed, and the reason is directly linked to the fact that he was drunk. And this is exactly how people who become incapacitated today become victims, because they're not able to protect their privacy and their dignity, and very often become exposed. And then there's pictures taken, all those kinds of things, where somebody is in a state that they would never be in if they were in their right mind. But because they are drunk, they end up being vulnerable. By the way, does this make it right for someone to take advantage of somebody like that? No. And in fact, as the story goes on, of course, Ham is going to be cursed, or his descendants, because of something related to this incident, the way that he handled it. And Shem and Japheth did the better thing by showing honor to their father. Even when he was incapacitated, they went out of their way to protect his honor. And men and women who are here, young and old, understand that there is no excuse and there's no defense for someone who would take advantage of someone who is unable, because even if it's their own fault that they're drunk or whatever, if they're not able to protect their own privacy and dignity, Shem and Japheth show us the right thing to do. You protect that person. You don't take advantage of that person or mock or somehow make fun of, expose to others their shame. That's what happens very often. You know, somebody's passed out or whatever, and then people post that or make a picture or do something to kind of make fun of or mock this person because of the state they're in. But Shem and Japheth show us the better way. And that is you be the one to step in and protect that person, not be the one to take advantage of that person. But in terms of how we can protect ourselves, or the danger that alcohol poses, that first story, gives us a good picture. You know, it's not very far. I think, in fact, it's the next time wine is mentioned, is when Lot and his daughters were escaping from Sodom and Gomorrah when they were destroyed. And they went up and lived in the hills. And it's a weird story because his daughters are worried that they're never going to have children and they're going to just die up there in the cave. And their thought was the only man around is our dad. And maybe we can have children by him, which seems, of course, bizarre and absurd to us. But in their minds, their thought was we're going to die husbandless and childless. And this is going to be the end of the whole family here in this cave. So the only thing we can do is to get pregnant by our father, which again is perverse, but that's the thought that goes through their mind. But they apparently knew that Lot would not go along with this, because the plan they came up with was let's make him drunk and then we can do what we want. And they did. They come, let us make our father drink wine and we will lie with him. And they made their father drink wine that night. The firstborn went in and lay with their father. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose. The next night, the next daughter did the same thing. And the same statement is made that he did not know when she lay down. What is that saying to you? That because he was drunk, he didn't know when she came in. He didn't know when she left. And I assume that it's saying he didn't know what happened in between when she came in and when she left. In other words, he was completely unaware of the entire incident. And this is just commonplace, and you hear people talk about waking up and not knowing what happened. And there's people that don't even know if they were assaulted or not, because they have no recollection of what happened the night before. And maybe a vague recollection, or maybe some troubling thought or some feeling that maybe something happened, but they're not sure. And that's exactly what happens with Lot here. And the reason it happened was because he was drunk. Now, an interesting thing to compare between these two men are that in both cases, Noah and Lot, they were the only good person saved out of a wicked society. Noah and his family, the Lord saw Noah that he was a righteous man. The Lord saw Lot that he was a good man. And the Lord miraculously saved both of them from the destruction of a wicked society. And yet, these two guys who were basically the only good people on earth or in their community, when given alcohol, did things that they probably would not normally do, seems to be the implication. So if a man who is like Noah, who could be the only righteous man on the earth, on the planet, could get drunk and pass out naked, and if Lot, who was the only righteous man in a city full of wicked people, could get drunk and sleep with his daughters and not know it, then it seems it would be silly for me to think somehow I'm better than the two of them. That I can get drunk and I'm not going to be in any danger. That I can get drunk and nothing bad is going to happen to me. Why would I think that I would be any different than they are? What seems to be clear is when somebody is drunk, they're very vulnerable to doing something that they wouldn't normally do, or things happening to them that they wouldn't normally allow. But because they are incapacitated, they are vulnerable to these attacks. Now, the Lord has strong language, of course, for people who would use alcohol to take advantage of others. In Habakkuk, there's this warning. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. This being a prophecy, it's hard for me to tell how much of this is figurative and literal, but the point's pretty clear. Whether he's using this as a figurative example or whether it's literally what they were doing, there was this known practice of somebody giving his neighbor a bunch of drink just to be able to expose his nakedness. And he would become vulnerable, which is what happened to Noah and what happens to Lot, that somebody made him drunk and then there he's exposed. And he said, woe to you who do that. But this is as old as time. Do you see what I'm saying? These stories about people who would, they want to have their way. They want to do something. They want to, whether it's sinister, which seems to be the case here, or whether it is because of a sexual desire, whatever the case, they have it in their head. They want something to do, but the way they're going to overpower the person is by giving them an intoxicant so that when that person becomes incapacitated or drunk, they're able to do what they want to do. And that whole thought has been going on since Genesis. So it's nothing new, and I don't think I'm telling anybody here anything you don't already know. But it's just interesting to see that has been going on throughout the history of mankind, that people will use alcohol to have their way with somebody who they know would probably put up some kind of a resistance. But in order to make that resistance go away, they'll get them drunk. and then they can do what they want to do. Other kinds of attacks besides exposing nakedness, well, there's a couple of examples where someone was physically attacked while incapacitated. Remember that Absalom hated his brother Amnon, his half-brother, because he raped his sister Tamar. And Absalom wanted to kill Amnon. And here's the plan he came up with. He told his men, when Amnon's drinking, he had him over for dinner. And he said, wait till his heart is merry with wine and then attack him. And so he waited until he had had a lot to drink, or enough to drink, that his heart was merry with wine. And then they attacked him. And then they rose and fled. There's another example of that. A king that we probably forget about, King Elah of Israel. I don't know that I would have ever come up with the name Elah. Probably Terry's the only one here. He's memorized all those kings who knew King Elah. Maybe some of the rest of you did. But anyway, in the 26th year of King Asa of Judah, Elah, the son of Baasha, began to reign over Israel in Tirzah, and he reigned 2 years. But his servant Zimri, commander of half his chariots, conspired against him. When he was at Tirzah, drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, who was over the household at Tirzah, Zimri came in and struck him down and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. So while he's drinking himself drunk, he's not going to be able to fight very well, is he? He isn't going to be able to defend himself from attack. He isn't going to be able to defend himself from someone coming in and doing what they want to him. And that's really the whole point. And hopefully that's coming through clearly, that drunkenness makes us vulnerable to attack. Turns me to Proverbs chapter 23. There's a great poetic description here of the effect of drunkenness. Proverbs 23. It's a very well-known proverb, but it touches on this theme that we're looking at today. Proverbs 23. And we'll begin in verse 29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? You see what that's saying? Like they wake up and they've got some kind of bruise or cut and they don't even know, where did this come from? How did I get this bruise? What happened to me? How did I get this injury? I don't even know. They have a wound without cause. Who does this happen to? Who has redness of eyes? Those who tarry long over wine, those who go to try mixed wine, do not look at it when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things, and your heart will utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink. Let's notice a couple of things here. First of all, that fit with the theme we've been looking at, and that is that someone who is tarrying long over the wine, someone who's drunk, is vulnerable. He lies down in the midst of the sea. You can't do that. You can't take a nap in the middle of the ocean. In other words, he's doing things that don't make any sense. Like he's lying on top of a mast. You just kind of picture in your mind some drunk person passed out somewhere on a park bench or whatever. They're just laying there. It's not an appropriate place. Verse 35 says, they struck me, you'll say, but I was not hurt. In other words, people are hitting him. It didn't bother him. It's notorious, but by the way, that drunk people seem to survive all kinds of things, right? If there's a crash and one of them's drunk, that's going to be the guy that's all right. Somehow it works in strange ways that their inability to protect themselves, they somehow survive. Oh, they hit me, but it didn't bother me any, he says. They beat me, but I didn't feel it. So many people get drunk and get in fights too, right? That's as old as time that, you know, people go to the bar and then somehow a fight breaks out. And I'm sure if they were all in their right mind, there would have been no fight. And there's probably nothing to fight about, but they're drunk. And so they're getting into fights. But also notice that, in addition to that, verse 33 says, your eyes will see strange things and your heart will utter perverse things. Not only are you vulnerable to someone doing something to you if you're drunk, you're also vulnerable to you doing something you wouldn't normally do and saying things you would not normally say. And this is, of course, is as well known as anything. That, you know, you hear all these stories of office parties and all, you know, somebody who is normally very reserved and professional, but they go to the Christmas party, they go to the boss, they go to the pool party, they go to wherever, and now they get a little drunk, and everybody sees a totally new side of them that they would, and they're saying things and doing things, and that's just That's a story as old as time too. Everybody knows it, right? When someone is intoxicated, they say and do things that they would not normally say and do. So you're not only vulnerable to someone doing something to you, you're vulnerable to acting in a way that you would not normally, under normal circumstances, act. And then also, of course, the addictive nature of alcohol is mentioned in the last verse, that even after all these things are happening, after all these bad effects of drunkenness, the person's only thought when he wakes up is his next drink. And that's a tragic thing, that there are people who get sober and are immediately making it through the day till the next time they can sit down and drink some more, making it to the next occasion, because they become addicted. Not everybody, by the way, of course, who drinks becomes an alcoholic, but a significant number do, and I don't think there's any way to know whether you would be susceptible to that or not, but it happens to a lot of people that they become addicted to it, and that's a tragic thing. It costs people so much. So many people, I think I've told this story before. I'm afraid I'm getting to that point where I start repeating my stories. But anyway, when I was growing up, there was a man that lived on the other side of the fence in my backyard in a refrigerator box, and his name was David. And this was a story I would tell kids at school. They didn't hardly believe me. No, there's not. Like, yeah, there's a guy that lives on the other side of the fence in a box. And so when they didn't believe me, we would creep around the corner, and I would show them, and there'd be David laying in his box. And they couldn't believe it. And every now and then, David would show up on our back door and ring the doorbell. I was scared of him. He was like a bogeyman to the rest of us, you know, like this kind of creepy guy that he was harmless, I think. If he wasn't in his box, he was sitting on the courthouse in Athens on a bench. So you'd either see him up there on the bench or he was in his box back there. All over the ground back there on the other side of the fence, just covering the ground, were rubbing alcohol bottles because that's what he could buy. And apparently you can drink rubbing alcohol. It's bad for you, from what I'm told. But it's cheap, and Athens was dry. And so that's what he would, just covered lots of rubbing alcohol bottles. But anyway, he would knock on the door sometimes and he would talk to Dad. And I remember Dad telling me that David had a family, and he had a wife and kids, and he had a house, and drinking had cost him all of that. And so he was now living in this box. And I guess he died. I don't ever know what happened to him. I mean, he was an older man at the time that I knew him growing up. But anyway, I grew up with David on the other side of the fence because of alcohol, because he was an alcoholic. And that's the picture that you have here painted for us. In a more general sense, as we kind of zoom out away from this and we think about the real enemy who's out to get us, turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 5 in the New Testament. 1 Peter chapter 5. You know this passage probably by heart. If I could start it, we'd probably all be able to quote it together. Beginning verse 8. Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him firm in your faith, knowing that the same kind of sufferings are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. Satan, like a roaring lion, is looking for someone to attack. So you need to resist him. Well, what have we seen so far? What would take away your ability to resist? Notice that he begins in verse 8 by saying, be sober-minded. Now, I think he's saying there, it's probably not literally talking about, just like when he's saying he's not literally a lion or, you know, be awake and all those things. It's a mindset, a spiritual mindset. But at the same time, I think we could see pretty clearly that if someone is physically intoxicated or drunk, they're not going to be in any shape to resist the attack of Satan, which means he's going to bring evil into your life, or you'll be very vulnerable to that. Not only is drunkenness itself a sin and a work of the flesh, but it's very often accompanied by other sins. That it's rare that drunkenness is a thing that's done all by itself, but usually drunkenness leads to and is part of a more sinful environment where other things are going on. And so Satan is going to easily have his way with people who are drunk. And when you think about, again, back to the story where we started, think about the ways that drunkenness contributes to that. Turn me back to chapter 4 of 1 Peter. Chapter 4 of 1 Peter. Look at verse 1. Since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. There, unfortunately, the what comes to mind in a for a lot of people when they think about going off to college is partying. And in the minds of a lot of people, young people, that's kind of what they look forward to. I mean, you're going to turn 21 most likely, but even then, most people don't even wait till they're 21. But you know, fraternity parties, campus parties, all those kinds of things. There's no adults for the most part supervising. You know, you have a lot of young people, and they're mostly single, and they're all clumped together somewhere, and they're looking to have a good time, and they've, you know, it's just, again, I'm not telling anybody here anything you don't know. That's what a lot of times people associate with college is partying. And that's a big part of what a lot of people do when they go to college. And it sounds exactly like what Peter's painting this picture of, which has basically been going on since the beginning of time, apparently. And that is people living for the passions of the flesh. Verse 3, living in sensuality, drunkenness, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. Maybe the idolatry doesn't fit the picture today, unless we think of it in terms of some materialism. But the rest of that all paints a pretty good picture of some kind of wild fraternity party or sorority party or wild campus type thing. Those things are almost synonymous in some ways with young people in college. And when you picture that scene, and it's a scene of a lot of drinking, and it's a scene of where casual sexual encounters are expected. And here's what I'm saying. There's people that get dressed for their evening, and they're putting on their cologne, and they're hoping that night to find somebody. Right? That's why they're going. I mean, that's what they're thinking in their mind. Right? They're thinking they're going to hook up. And there's apps that can help you do that. But their goal is to go and hopefully hook up with somebody and enjoy the passions of the flesh. That's what they're looking forward to. So when they're drunk and when the people are drunk, is it any surprise that there's people pushing themselves past the boundary where they should? That there's people who go a little too far and then try to stop things and they won't take no for an answer? Or the people that misread signals or don't even care about signals because they're fueled up on hormones and alcohol and they're not going to take no for an answer. And you could see how this is a perfect storm of a setting where the kinds of statistics that we were looking at take place. And in fact, the people that reported these incidents said 62% of them had been drinking in the, you know, previously to that. And they're making the, I didn't suggest that. They're making the connection. The people who are doing the study are making the connection between alcohol abuse and sexual assault, that these two things are linked together, and you can easily see how that could happen. On the other hand, verse 4 and 5 says, with respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you, but they will give account to him who's ready to judge the living and the dead. They're surprised. I think it's the King James says, they do not run with them to the same excess of dissipation. You do not run with that crowd. And they're surprised. So here's what that's saying. The crowd's running over here, and you, as a Christian young person, are not running with the crowd, and the crowd is surprised. Or this doesn't just apply to young people, it's adults too. Everybody's running in this direction because that's fun, and you're not doing what they're doing, and they're surprised, and they don't necessarily respect you for that, so they malign you, they speak against you. Like, oh well, you know, they're no fun, they're no good, they're not going to do what everybody else is doing. And so they don't have anything nice to say about you necessarily because you're not joining them in the things that they do for fun. But as we can see, doing things the Lord's way is much better for us. It's a very simple way to dramatically reduce your risk of being a victim of a violent crime and dramatically reduce your risk of doing something that you wouldn't normally do. Not to mention the fact that if you're not running in that crowd, you're not going to be sinning and you're not going to have sin against the Lord, and you're not going to have that on your conscience. It's interesting that when, in that same study that I referred to in the very beginning, they asked the people in the survey, what could students do to help the problem? The number one response was men could be more respectful toward women. Some 93% said that. That is true. And I don't want to do the whole victim blaming thing here and say it's the woman's fault for this. It's not. It's the guy's. If you should never under any circumstances take advantage of anybody, especially when they're not, when they're vulnerable. That's horrible. And so the lion's share of the blame goes to the guy who would do that, right? I mean, that he's the one who's at fault. He's the one who's doing something he should not be doing. And if guys wouldn't do that, the problem would go away for the most part. But as a, you can't necessarily control very much about what everybody else is going to do. It'd be nice if you could, right? But what can you do about the problem? Number two, 77% of those surveyed said drink less alcohol. Which is interesting. They're surveying people who've been on college campuses, not necessarily religious people or anything like that. And they're just saying, what could people do to make this better? Number one, guys could treat women with respect. Number two, people could drink less. Because 3/4 of the people they talk to understand the link between alcohol abuse and sexual assault. The world knows this. I'm not, again, this is not anything kind of shocking or new or surprising. This is kind of common knowledge that people understand the link between these. So you would wonder then, why doesn't everybody act on that? Well, it's because it's what everybody's doing. It's fun. It's what they want to do. And they're willing to take the risk is what it boils down to. They're willing to take the risk because that's what everybody's doing. And they enjoy the worldly part of that. But along with that comes some very serious dangers. And that's the point. That's hopefully what's come through clearly in our lesson today. The fact is there's plenty of wholesome ways to have a good time. Sometimes people think the Bible is all about ruining your fun, that God just doesn't want you to be able to enjoy anything. So everything you think is fun or good, he's going to tell you no, and you're not allowed to do that. That's not true. That's the devil lying to you, by the way. There's so many fun, enjoyable things that there's nothing in the whole wide world wrong with that you can do with your friends, with your family, with people that you will not wake up feeling guilty about, that you will not be in grave danger of being assaulted, that you will not be sinning against the Lord, that you will not be run some risk of getting pregnant or diseased or injured. There's so many things that are, and in fact, and in reality, I would suggest they're probably more fun. Not to say that there's no pleasure in sin, because there clearly is pleasure in sin, but there is so much out there and good ways to spend time together. It's just a matter of being willing to be different. It's a matter of being willing to not do what everybody around you is doing, what everybody expects you to do. And that's the hard part, but that's part of being a Christian. Because if we're going to follow Jesus, then we're not going with the crowd. And we just got to be willing to do that. And hopefully this lesson has been helpful encouragement and admonition along those lines. Perhaps there's someone here this morning who needs to make something right in your life. If you need to be baptized and have your sins washed away, that would be awesome. We've had several baptisms lately, and that's great. It's a big boost to us. But most importantly, it means the soul getting right with God. But perhaps there's someone who's already been baptized, and you've wandered off course, and you've been caught up in the world again. The lion has taken a chunk out of you. The Lord can heal you. He's more powerful than Satan, and he can make it right. And if you would like for us to pray with you and pray for you, we'd be glad to do that. If there's any way we can help, let us know as we stand and sing.